This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. In March of 2006, all eyes were on Duke University. Three white lacrosse players were charged with raping an African-American exotic dancer. The case raised questions and incited passions about race, gender, and class. Ultimately, the lacrosse players were found innocent. Evidence showed the victim falsified her story, and former Durham District Attorney Mike Nifong lost his license because of several charges, most notably withholding evidence. Investigative journalist and writer William D. Cohen wasn't satisfied with the outcome. He felt a trial was necessary in a case like this, so he wrote a book aiming to assess the pieces of evidence that were never brought before a judge. The book is The Price of Silence, The Duke Lacrosse Scandal, The Power of the Elite, The Corruption of Our Great Universities. And Bill Cohen is on our program today. Welcome, Bill. Good to talk with you.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
Tell us in more detail why you decided to write this book.
Well, I guess the easiest thing for me to have done after working on Wall Street for 17 years and then for the last 10 years writing about Wall Street, including three books about Wall Street, was to continue to write about Wall Street. But as a Duke alum, I was sort of, A, curious about what really had happened in this case because I never felt like I got a satisfactory answer. You know, there was no trial. It was just sort of decreed by Attorney General Roy Cooper in April 2007 that these players were, quote unquote, innocent, which is not even a term used widely in the legal setting. So I was curious about what really happened. And, of course, I wanted to know I wanted to try to figure out why there was such passion about this on both sides, why the media had grabbed hold of this like no other case in recent memory. I mean, this was the Flight 370 and Bridgegate wrapped up into one, as we all remember. Very high passions in the media against the players, and then equally high passions in the media against Crystal Mangum and Mike Nifong. And so as an investigative journalist, as a Duke alum, I wanted to know what happened in a dispassionate way.
When you, I mean, and of course you talk about why the fact that there was no trial, Roy Cooper famously pronounced them innocent instead of the legal term of art, not guilty, as you point out. But the reason was, you know, an ethics panel of the state bar found Mike Nifong guilty of prosecutorial misconduct, primarily for withholding exculpable evidence and for inflammatory statements that he made to the press, all deemed unethical by the state board.
State bar.
Bar, yeah.
Well, first of all, Roy Cooper declared the boys innocent on April 11th, 2007, well before the state bar ended up ruling against Mike Nifong. Of course, it was a brilliant legal strategy for the defense. Certainly, one has to commend them for their legal acumen, for turning the whole story on its head and exploiting every mistake that both Crystal Mangum and Mike Nifong made in this case. But you basically have to wonder why a previously toothless state bar in North Carolina, which, of course, had barely disciplined a district attorney, let alone brought one up on charges that were levied here against Mike Nifong, suddenly found passion, found ambition, found aggression, and filed these two charges against Mike Nifong, forcing him into a position where he had to recuse himself and then see if Roy Cooper wanted to take the case. And, of course, he did. What I talk about in the book, which is, frankly, a very interesting moment, seminal moment, is after Mike Nifong realizes he's going to have to recuse himself in late December of 2006, he wants to talk to Crystal Mangum and tell her what he's going to do. She is giving birth to her third child in a hospital in, I think, Chapel Hill, and almost dies in childbirth. But she recovers from that and goes to see Mike Nifong. He tells her what he's intending to do, which he has to recuse himself. He's going to turn the case over to Roy Cooper if, in fact, Crystal Mangum believes that she wants to go forward with the case because it was going to be, you know, very difficult and brutal for her going forward to try to make these charges in a court of law. And that would have been a perfect opportunity. Remember, the rape charge had been dropped earlier in December. That would have been a perfect opportunity for her to say, you know what, I give up on this. My memory is wrong. I'm bipolar. I'm a drug addict. I'm not going to go forward with this, as everyone would have us believe. And instead, she says, no, I still believe something happened, and I want to bring this to fruition in a trial. Mike Nifong tested her on that many times. She said she wanted to go forward with it, turned the case over to Roy Cooper, and of course we know what happened then.
You spoke with Crystal Mangum as well, and you are now convinced that that she was assaulted in some way that night. Is that right?
Well, let me be clear on this, that this is something we'll never know. So what I think almost doesn't matter. But I'm happy to try to answer the question from my impressions. And it's not just impressions that I got from speaking to Crystal Mangum, but it's also impressions that I got from reading Tara Levacy's report in the hospital that first night, the same nurse who examined her, from reading the police reports in detail, from talking to Mike Nifong, from talking to Robert Steele, the head of the Board of Trustees at Duke. As somebody who's a student of human nature, my impression, frankly, at this point is that something did happen in that bathroom that none of us would be proud of. And I know my critics, of which there are many, love to seize on me when I say that. But I just don't buy into the whole defense narrative that this was nothing but a major league conspiracy by Crystal Mangum, Tara Levacy, Mike Nifong, and you know, the administration at Duke to you know, bury these kids under an avalanche of false allegations.
Well, some of the critiques that did come out and the actual charges when the bar did finally issue its report seem pretty serious and pretty damning. And we can start with perhaps the least serious, which is his statements to the press, you know, particularly when he says they don't want to admit the enormity of what they have done. Seems to go beyond the scope of what a DA should be saying at that point. And then the other quote to the media in March of 2006, and one would wonder why one needs an attorney if one is not charged and had not done anything wrong. Doesn't that cut against the whole principle of jurisprudence in America, that somehow my asking for an attorney is an admission of guilt?
There's no question that everybody is entitled to an attorney. And I think Mike Nifong would be the first one, and he was to me, to say that many of his statements were ill-advised. And I'm sure if he had to do it again, he wouldn't make those statements. He did explain to me the logic of why he did that. You know, people can buy into that or not. But as he says, importantly in the book, had the white players on the Duke lacrosse team, which of course was all but one, had they voluntarily given DNA evidence to the police, as was the initial plan, Coach Pressler had agreed with the police that the players would give DNA swabs, after a practice one day. Had they originally followed through with that plan, then he didn't think there would be a Duke lacrosse case. Well within their rights, of course, was to hire attorneys before voluntarily agreeing to give the DNA. They did hire those attorneys. Those attorneys apparently advised them not to do that, so that was called off. The police still wanted to collect the DNA evidence, so they put together what was called a non-testimonial order, where forced the police to show probable cause to, and then therefore they put in their narrative what they thought happened based on talking to Tara Levacy, talking to Crystal Mangum, doing whatever other investigation they had done, and they laid out a very damning narrative about what they believe happened. Brought that to an assistant district attorney in Mike Nifong's office. Mike Nifong knew nothing about it. He signed off on it. It went before a judge, and the judge approved it. And that document was made public. And basically all hell broke loose after that.
Well, the DNA evidence didn't get to the defense attorneys in the time that it should. The law says it needs to go as soon as the DA, as soon as that report is available. And according to the state bar, the final report, when he and Nifong received DSI's written report and provided it to counsel for the Duke defendants, Nifong was fully aware that the test results were omitted, test results that showed that there was no DNA evidence linking those lacrosse players or any of the lacrosse team to the DNA that was found in Crystal Mangum, that he deliberately, that he was aware that the test results were omitted. This is exculpatory evidence. He knew it wasn't there, and he went ahead and then later told a judge that as far as the state was concerned, they had everything, which the bar said is, again, unethical. You lied to a judge.
Well, again, you know, I think readers have to decide. I think many people have their minds made up on this issue. Mike Nifong's version is that first, when he got the results from the state bar, from the state SBI, the state lab, he turned those results over to the attorneys for the defense, who then immediately, probably without even reading them, but reading a summary of them, immediately held a press conference on the steps of the Durham courthouse, and you know, proclaimed their client's innocence, which is, of course, what they are entitled to do, and asked Mike Nifong to drop the charges. Mike Nifong then turned over additional evidence, DNA evidence, to a private lab in Burlington, which did an examination of that evidence, produced a report. Summary report that was turned over to the defense, and then he, in due course, turned over all of the DNA evidence to the defense, all of the backup pages, thousands of documents, which the defense then intelligently, cleverly, brilliantly, some would say, plowed through ad nauseum, Brad Bannon, and discovered that not only was there no DNA evidence from the players, but there was DNA evidence from four males who were not Duke lacrosse players on her or in her, as they like to say. So Mike Nifong would say that he did turn over the evidence, a complete evidence, in a timely fashion. He has always been someone who was the first to turn over all evidence, even before it was required, to the defense. He was a champion of that. He also told me on many occasions that the absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence, which I guess is a term lawyers like to throw around, which basically means that just because in his mind there was no DNA evidence from these players on or in Crystal Mangum does not mean that what she described didn't happen. Because for many years, thousands of years before we had DNA evidence, DNA testing available, and everybody became a CSI aficionado, rape charges were brought, and people were convicted or found not guilty of rape charges based on the testimony of the victim. And, you know, Mike Nifong believed this victim, believed the police, believed Tara Levesey, and was prepared to move forward with the case and was prepared to lose if that's what would happen, just as he has won some rape cases and lost some rape cases in the past. To me, it seems to me that, you know, just like Michael Lewis described in his book about the stock market being rigged, I think the justice system in this case was rigged so that there was no trial in this case. That's not the way the system is supposed to work. The system is supposed to work, whether you like it or not, with a district attorney believing a crime was committed and wanting to bring that case to trial, and having a jury decide whether or not the people charged are guilty or innocent. And this was completely subverted in this case.
Well, the disturbing thing to the state bar counsel, Catherine Jean, who you quote in the book, about not turning that DNA evidence over until he was forced to do it, not turning it over when he had it, was that, as she points out, many cases never go to trial. They end in plea deals. These particular clients had the means to fight, but, quote, for defendants who don't have the means to fight and haven't been shown that there's DNA evidence that's exculpatory and end up pleading guilty, it's a scary concept. It's not that there hasn't been a history of not believing rape victims. It's that when you don't use and abide by all of the rules of conduct as a district attorney with the authority to restrict your freedom, that's another way of rigging the system. And that's the concern certainly of the state bar in this case.
Well, I agree that was the concern of the state bar, which is probably why they moved forward with this complaint against Mike Nifong. Somehow they found courage to do that. Maybe they thought it was so egregious. But the fact remains that the evidence was turned over to the defense, and the defense combed through it as they were more than happy to trumpet how they found this, and Mike Nifong had withheld it from them. You know, I'm not sure that that's true. He turned over the evidence when... well before there was going to, he turned it over in, guess what, October or November. There was no even trial even scheduled. It was going to be in the spring at the earliest. So, and as we know, Brad Bannon likes to talk about how he found the evidence and, you know, just, you know, revealed that other people, not these players, had their DNA on or in her. And again, I think Mike Nifong's point is, as a seasoned prosecutor, is that, again, the absence of evidence isn't the evidence of absence. That doesn't mean that what she described as possibly happening didn't necessarily happen.
Bill, good to talk with you. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
William D. Cohen is the author of The Price of Silence, The Duke Lacrosse Scandal, The Power of the Elite, and the Corruption of Our Great Universities. And that's our program for today. Thank you for listening. The State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Nicole Campbell, Megan Modafferi, and Anita Rao. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is our news director. You can find us online at stateofthings.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.